This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about body image and eating disorders. It's a link that is understood, but can often be a lot more complicated and nuanced in a way that we sometimes take for granted. So we were really delighted to be rejoined by James Downes, a previous guest in one of the lockdown bonus episodes from, I'm not sure how many weeks ago, but somewhat recently, still losing track of time a little bit in this lockdown. So first off, from the charity Beat, 1.25 million people in the UK have an eating disorder. That's more than the entire population of Birmingham, where we are, which is the second largest city in the UK. However, research from the NHS suggests that the figure could easily be more than double when looking at symptoms in the population, rather than just those who are diagnosed. Even on its own, 1.25 million is a massive figure for how many people have eating disorders. But then it's interesting how when the NHS are looking at how many people have symptoms, then the figures are so much higher. And I think that really speaks to how normalized the pressure on our body image can be, that oftentimes we don't even realize certain things could be symptoms because thinness and dieting and overexercising can so often be held up as aspirational, even when they become unhealthy.
Yes, I absolutely agree, Bobby. And those stats are astounding, really. But I can imagine so many more people that are eating unhealthily, exercising in a way that's too much, and that we don't actually recognise it within our families and our friends and all around us, really. And just because there's not a label or somebody hasn't been diagnosed doesn't mean that there's some unhealthy behaviours and interactions with eating and diet and all that kind of stuff. That's the worrying thing, really.
Right. Well, it's quite a tricky one, isn't it? Because on one hand, it's really important to have an understanding of eating disorders and what that means and why these symptoms are so dangerous. But that's not to say just because you have a symptom here and there, that's the same as having one either. There are times when we all miss meals, maybe we forget. And that's not the same as you necessarily doing it on purpose. It's more to do with the regularity of these unhealthy behaviours or the potential escalation in particular, where you're getting thinner and thinner, far beyond, you know, anything a doctor might recommend of losing a bit of weight, but equally weight gain as well with some conditions. And I think particularly at the moment with the pandemic, we're even more at risk in many ways. I don't know many people in my personal life that are still having the usual three meals a day and have the same routine. So often our eating fits around our work day, and we don't, a lot of us have that right now. And equally, then there's all the pressure on the amount we exercise and staying proactive. And we can easily turn a lot of that focus in on ourselves in a way that is too much and can be unhealthy.
Absolutely. And I mean, you've never looked at yourself as much as you have during this pandemic on Zoom and every other screen that you have in like video calls with, constantly looking at yourself. Even you and I, everything's been over Skype, and I just see myself all the time. You just don't live your life normally like that. You see things outwardly rather than always every conversation or interaction that you've had for 3 months, unless it's just been, you know, via phone, has probably been with your picture of yourself looking back at you. Actually, it does play on the mind. How do I look? How do I look every day? And also, everything on social media that you see is all about exercise and people staying fit. And I actually went to the GP myself during this time of this last few months and said, oh, I know I've put on a few pounds. And she said, actually, Danielle, nobody has sat in this chair that hasn't either gained quite a lot or dramatically lost the other way. And that was quite a surprise. She said, you know, you'd really be surprised. She hasn't seen anybody that has just completely leveled out. Definitely down to what we've all gone through, and a lot of people use food as comfort.
Right.
So there's so many contributing factors.
Right. And with all that looking on social media, what we're not seeing is people in real life. You know, we're seeing the photos that are potentially filtered or the best angle. A lot of my modeling friends are sharing old pictures from their portfolio. So they don't even look remotely like that at this point. You know, some of them I'm looking at and I'm like, I don't even remember you having that haircut. And, you know, and it's all just further warping that. But that's a really good point. It's really interesting. And I can certainly see why. But then also within that is why this topic is so important and why we're so vulnerable right now, that so many more people could have crossed that line during this time from maybe disordered eating to then an eating disorder, that separation.
Absolutely.
It's perfectly understandable that people's weight will change during this time. But today we'll be specifically looking at what's beyond that. We're talking more generally about that relationship between body image and eating disorders. But no, you're quite right. A lot of it is linked. And so whilst for many of us, we're making peace with body changes we might be going through under this time, there is also a lot of making light of it, which for some people is healthy, like talking about the quarantine 15, it's in 15 pounds. A lot of people feel they're putting on. You know, equally for those of us dealing with an eating disorder, that can be potentially harmful to see as well. So we'll be talking about a lot of this nuance in today's episode.
And just because you have issues with the way you see your body doesn't necessarily mean you have an eating disorder and vice versa. You know, I don't think people really understand. I don't think people really understand that anorexia is a mental illness. I don't think that's talked about enough. And people that aren't in that, you know, environment or don't have that understanding often think it's really is to do with your body image and it's all about your body image. Episodes like this and talking to people like James really do help us understand that crossover.
Definitely. I think it's a great general conversation that whether you have experience of eating disorders or not, there'll be a lot to relate to. And definitely, I think all of us can benefit from increased body image and the confidence that can be so closely linked to that. So I'm really looking forward to sharing this conversation with James Downs. He's a mental health and eating disorder campaigner. He also blogs and is a speaker and educator across the UK and a yoga teacher, a parallel but linked career of his. He's also most recently been taken on as a lived experience designer at Mind Charity, where he advises them on how to campaign better. So very exciting. You know, it's obviously some caliber of campaigner when a charity is taking you on and being like, we need help to do this better. Please come join us.
And you can see why, can't you? He's a great guy.
Absolutely. So please enjoy this really illuminating, in-depth interview with James Downs in a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
Hi, my name's James. When I look back at when I might have developed mental health problems, I think the thing that really strikes me is that I wasn't aware of the things I was experiencing as a younger child being related to mental health. And actually, although I was diagnosed with mental health problems around the age of 15, 16, I think that there were definitely roots and symptoms. You know, you might call them symptoms, you might just call them experiences that went back much before that age. And the thing that really strikes me is that they seemed really normal to me at the time. And I look back and think, okay, that wasn't actually normal. But the way that things emerged, for me, that was just normal. And that was just what I did. And that was, you know, maybe I didn't know that other people didn't do these things. So I struggled a lot with my body image growing up. And I think I can't really tell exactly when the problems started, but I was always really self-conscious about undressing, and I always felt really uncomfortable with going swimming, for example. You know, it must have been from about 8 or 9 years old. I wouldn't swim with my top off. I didn't see that that was not normal. And I think my parents were so understanding about things in a way, they enabled that to be normalized. I just didn't swim with my top off. And I think going to high school, I found high school really, really stressful. Before then, I had quite a normal relationship with eating and food, but I stopped eating when I went to high school for the whole day. So I would eat my breakfast and then I would go to school. And maybe because I had a lot of distress and anxiety around going to school, I wouldn't eat in school at all, and I wouldn't drink. And I had this sort of phobia almost of going to the bathroom because I wouldn't want to maybe use my body and have bodily functions. I just felt like I was shutting down my body. And then at the end of the day, I would come home from school and wake it up again, and I would eat kind of normally, or I would eat a lot more than perhaps somebody else would because I hadn't eaten all day.
That's really interesting because it sounds like you had a deep self-consciousness. So not just in terms of food, but in terms of anything that might draw attention to you in that way.
Yeah, I was extremely self-conscious of my physical presence or the way I might be perceived by other people. And I wouldn't change in the changing rooms. I would really, really dislike that when it was time for sort of PE or sports in school. And yeah, I felt this need to somehow suppress my body and to be in control of it. And that way, somehow, it might be acceptable to other people. And I think I had a fear that got worse and worse. You know, that idea of when did it all start? Even though I didn't have a diagnosed mental health problem for years, that went on. There were definitely things there that I would now consider to do with mental health. But at the time, I didn't know that. It wasn't on my radar. It wasn't on my family's radar. It was something that was just so normalized that that was just how I lived and how I related to my body, and that was it.
And it's interesting that you mentioned control earlier in relation to your body. Do you feel like you felt control in your life more broadly at the time?
I think that I didn't feel a sense of control in school because I felt the environment was really threatening and I felt really unstimulated and like I didn't have many friends and there was something really quite threatening about it. So yes, you know, maybe if you control things, you feel a sense of safety from that. But the point is the safety. And I found the environment really, really threatening and I needed ways to be safe. So maybe I obtained that through control and through suppressing my body and controlling what I was eating and when and controlling my physical appearance quite a lot. I became extremely preoccupied with how I looked. And I think that I was spending several hours per day getting ready for school and that only escalated. So with every year that I was in high school, it got worse and worse. And I remember going on music courses when I was about 12 or 13 because I did a lot of music and violin and stuff like this. And these residential courses, you would have to get up at 8 o'clock for breakfast and then the day would start and you'd have all your rehearsals and all that kind of stuff. But in order to get up and be there for breakfast at 8 o'clock, I was setting my alarm for 4 o'clock in the morning. And then we'd have these 9 or 10 hours of rehearsals. I did that for the whole week.
And what did that getting ready process look like for you?
Really elaborate rituals around showering and washing and using certain products and certain orders and being very fixated on different parts of my body that needed a lot of checking. Some of the focuses were like around my hair having to be absolutely perfect and I would always cut it. And there was one time when I cut my hair so much that, you know, it was never perfect. So I just cut more and more and more. And then I cut down all the way to the scalp and then that had to be somehow fixed, you know, but it was never going to be perfect. It would never meet the exacting standards that I had because they were impossible. I think probably the point was that I never felt enough. So however much I could control my appearance, I never felt like it would be enough to be acceptable. And it got to the point where in high school, I was getting ready, you know, for hours to go to school. And I was always really late because I couldn't get ready on time. And I would walk to the school and I would feel like I was so hideous that I'd done everything that I could, everything I possibly could to be acceptable to be in public and to be around other people. Because I felt like I was exposing other people to something awful just by being there, just by existing. I felt that if I was walking on the road to school and a car saw me, they would be so shocked by how ugly I was that they would crash their car. And so I couldn't walk on the pavements. And to me, that was absolutely real. I genuinely believed that. And part of me could see, okay, maybe that's not realistic, like, you know, that's not rational. But at the time, I was so convinced about it that it shaped my behaviour. So I wouldn't walk on the roads. I'd have to walk on the lanes. I'd have to wait until there was no traffic to cross the road. I'd have to go on all kinds of long routes just to try and make it to school. And then often I wouldn't be able to go into the building and I would just feel paralysed. And I was almost hiding from people on the road. And then I would have to find something to do with my day so that I could go home at 3:30 and say I'd been to school. And I was hiding it for quite a long time, actually. There were other things that weren't to do with my body image as well. Like I was very concerned about security and I would push all my furniture against my bedroom door at night because I thought somebody would come in and violently attack me. I had a lot of intrusive thoughts about that, and that I felt that I was a threat. So I had to check behind doors, had to check inside cupboards, just in case somebody wasn't there with a knife, you know? And that was also pretty real to me. Even though over time I realized that it was irrational, I think in some ways that only made it a bit worse, because I knew that it wasn't rational, but I was still thinking it and still feeling it. So I was even more aware of the fact that it was two realities trying to compete with each other, and that made me feel even worse. But,
right. And I think in that way, there's a strange advantage when you're young, that your imagination and the real world are quite blended. And so it allows some of these experiences to actually cause less distress, because you're using your imagination more as a child anyway. And then as you look back on them, you can realize more and more, wow, I thought that way.
Yeah, exactly. I look back and think, goodness, that was completely detached from reality, because there's nothing offensive about the way that I looked then or the way that I look now. And at the same time, it was so real to me. It was probably just displacement of other feelings that I felt, like the feeling of feeling threatened and the feeling of not being acceptable, or that I wasn't safe somehow. And it wasn't necessarily a physical feeling of not being safe in reality. You know, I probably was physically safe, but to me, I actually felt existentially at threat, and like had such a heightened level of anxiety and fear that I wasn't safe and that I wasn't acceptable, that it became a physical feeling, even though maybe it was just an emotional feeling or a social feeling. It was as real to me as though somebody was going to attack me or somebody was going to crash their car. I think it was really, really difficult to cope with, especially the fact that I just felt like I was coping with it on my own, because I didn't tell anyone about it throughout all that time, partly because I thought it was normal, because I'd adapted so well to adapt your whole life in all these different ways and to cover it up and to keep it secret. That's recruiting a lot of ingenuity and a lot of skills, including lying, you know? And if I think of it in that way, that I was just clinging on to any kind of way to stay safe. I think, well, you know, you did your best. In some ways, it's quite remarkable. In other ways, it's just really, really sad.
Yeah, I think that's a really good way of looking at it, actually, having that empathy for yourself and your mindset at the time. Because as you say, feeling safe was the priority. That's what your focus was. So with the tools you had and your mental state at the time, you really were trying your best.
I think I have that compassion for myself now. And that's probably a fundamental belief I have about people. And it does help me sometimes to make sense of people's behavior that just doesn't make sense, to try and see it with a compassionate kind of lens.
Right. And then with you dealing with this mostly on your own at that point, when did diagnosis and potentially help come in from that?
Yeah, diagnosis came when I sort of couldn't keep it under the rug anymore. And it spilled over because the consequences started to become obvious. So I missed a lot of school because of this behavior, which I didn't understand as OCD. I just thought that that's just the way I am. And actually, part of that was feeling really alienated and that there must be something really wrong with me, because I didn't know that it was a condition. So I just thought, I'm a bad person and I can't do what other people do because I'm not enough. And that only fed in to feeling like I wasn't acceptable and that I was maybe at risk. It was the end of a school year, around 15, 16 years old. My parents went to parents' evening, and I didn't have the best relationship with the teachers or with the school. And they said, you know, where has James been this year? His attendance is around, you know, 12, 13% or something like this. And where has he been for the rest of the time? They were really surprised and really shocked. And the school, they understood it in terms of bad behavior, and that I just didn't want to go to school because I didn't like them. And also because maybe I thought I was too good for them and that I was going to do well anyway, which kind of was the case because I was really high achieving. They probably thought, James doesn't think he needs to come to school anymore. And yeah, I was really rude to them sometimes because I didn't feel that they understood, and I felt really unsatisfied, dissatisfied in school.
And also you were feeling very isolated. So it sounds like that could be part of the lashing out as well.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't think that anybody really understood it in terms of mental health, including me. My parents were surprised. They came home and they were really angry as well. And I think that...
And so they didn't know you weren't going to school?
Because I'd kept it undercover for so long. I think they knew that I was a bit frustrated, feeling like I wasn't learning stuff and maybe not getting on with people as well as I would have liked, but that they didn't know the extent to which I was missing school. I think they were quite angry, but it didn't last for very long because actually the truth started to come out and I explained to them what was going on for me. And I was really, really upset. And I think that was the first time that I got really, really upset about it, because I felt like this isn't fair. And because I felt like I was being attacked for something that I was finding really, really difficult. And I felt like I was just doing my best, really. And there was a lot of effort involved. And my efforts were not being seen. Because when I did go to school, that was an amazing achievement. And it had taken me hours to get there. And that wasn't being seen. It was just, you haven't come all of these other times. I really somehow got upset in a way that I recognized, hang on, this is too much to be coping with on your own. And this isn't right. And it's not actually normal, even though I've somehow told myself that this is normal for me as a bad, abnormal person. And I think that I realized I needed help. So I said that I wanted to go to the GP, and my parents supported that. And I went to the GP not long after, and I explained everything that was going on, and they suggested a diagnosis of OCD. That was a relief in some ways, because I had a way to understand the behavior and the symptoms that I was experiencing, and I had something to tell the school, but they didn't really know at all how to respond to that or how to still include me in education, and things didn't get better fast. I started to go to CAMHS, so in Child and Adolescent Mental Health Services, they saw me quite rapidly. And actually, I look back and think, for the time, for 15 years ago, I had quite rapid intervention. That's great. Not everyone has that even now. But I felt that they also wanted to get me out of services quite fast. And somehow there were a lot of judgments about me and the kind of person that I was and what I needed that didn't really reflect reality as I saw it or what I was going through. I remember being told so many times, oh, you're really bright. You're going to respond really well to this CBT. And I did get the concepts of it, but it didn't mean that I could do it. And it didn't mean that I had the support that I needed to do it. In a sense, they didn't see it as much more than a behavioural problem, when actually I saw it, and I certainly see it now, as about some fundamental underlying distress or dis-ease or something that was not content in my relationship with myself and other people.
And it's interesting as an outsider hearing that, because from what you've described, you'd actually put in so much work yourself on coping. Of course, many of those coping mechanisms were maladaptive and weren't helping you, but were seemingly helping the fears and the concerns you had around your body. It helped you feel more comfortable with all of that. And then to go into something like CBT, which is similarly very skills-based, hearing you explain it, it's very clear that there was that emotional underlying problem, and that was the thing that wasn't being met. You were doing your best to cope and build up skills, but what was underneath that was being ignored. Exactly. And perhaps that's why when you did speak to your parents, that was such an emotional release, because that was the part that was being completely pushed down.
Yeah, and I was pushing that down as well with these behaviours that I was wrapping myself in as almost as a cocoon, but I was doing something to try and cope. And I think I found it quite threatening that they wanted to take away all those things that I developed to cope with my experience of the world. And they upheld this idea that you're obviously not ugly. You're obviously really bright. You'll understand this. You're going to have a great life. You've got everything going for you. That actually the ways that I was coping and my view of myself, even though it was not based in reality, as in I wasn't disfigured, even though I thought that I was, there was nobody there to say, but that is still real in some sense to you. It was just, well, that's obviously completely not right. Look at you. You're great. You're bright. You're young. And I think what I really wanted was, before I was going to be able to access the idea that I could change and let go of all these things, was somebody to say, well, I see and understand why you've been coping in the ways that you do. And I see that perhaps for you, you think that you're hideous, or you have this embodied sense of shame because you feel worthless. I didn't get that. And I just got, well, don't be so ridiculous. Because these coping mechanisms were taken away, I felt like they wrestled them off me. They said, you know, you can't have any mirrors in the house. You've got to get out in a certain amount of time. We'll supervise you. Your parents can supervise you. I was left without this cocoon and armor that I tried to wrap around myself. Just felt even more raw and exposed to all of these emotional things. And that's the point when somebody should have stepped in and actually helped me hold them and understand them, or somehow work with them. But because that didn't happen, I just looked for other behaviours to recruit and shifted to additional obsessions about my food and my consumption and my actual weight, which wasn't something that I'd wanted to control before then. It was more just my outward appearance rather than specifically weight and shape. Part of me looks back and thinks maybe I was escalating my behaviours to something that was more visible, because I would hope that they might see the distress that was going on underneath it, and that I was unwell, or that I was physically unwell, and somehow that was more valid than being mentally unwell. But
just want to pause on that. Clearly something that was missed in that initial treatment was that you'd already learnt to ignore reality. So all these other signs that you were acceptable, you were enough, you were loved, you'd already managed to screen those out, and those weren't influencing how you felt about yourself. So then for someone new to come in and try and do that, you know, of course that wasn't going to resonate, or it was going to be very difficult for it to. And so it's really interesting to hear that perspective of you potentially moving more into like physical health that might be easier seen because you're trying to show your reality and have that understood and acknowledged.
Yeah, I think that there's something kind of controversial in there, really, that I felt like the very ways that I had to stay safe were no longer accessible to me, and I couldn't really think of many other things that I could do. It's not a massive jump to make from appearance to how does my frame look? How does my weight and my shape look? So I can compassionately see why.
How did your family perceive how you were coping? Did they see changes?
I think my family became really worried when they saw that things weren't really getting better, or that I became engaged in what felt like a conflict with the people who were trying to treat me or the services that were trying to treat me. Somebody's trying to take away your coping mechanism, you're not going to be happy about it. And especially if they try and take it away in a way where it makes you feel stupid for having it in the first place, because it's so obviously irrational, and they don't acknowledge that there is some part in there that is rational to you. It has to be a sort of team effort. And if it's going to really work and you want to feel like someone's on your side. And my parents, yes, they were really worried when they saw that I would get really upset because I ended up, you know, not going to school a lot and had to come out of school. That actually I was quite relieved to speak to a psychiatrist, you know, a really educated professional. I hadn't spoken to many people that week at all, perhaps, and I'd go and see the psychiatrist. And it was actually really nice to have a debate with a psychiatrist. And I would really argue them on every single point, obviously as a way to avoid having to comply with the treatment. And I did feel a sense of empowerment from that, because I felt no empowerment in other areas of life. That were just, by that point, they were just falling away. You know, you can't see what I'm going through.
What you've made me think of describing those interactions with the psychiatrist is if, again, that's a way that you were trying to force your reality, that you were using your intellect and, again, what skills you did have to be like, look, this is real. I need you to believe me. I need you to engage in this, even if it doesn't make sense. I need you to engage in the emotional side, which is 100% real for me.
Absolutely. And I can get the intellectual side of it, but I think I was really so desperate for somebody to hear what it felt like for me and the emotional side of it. Even if I could understand their point of view and their arguments, I felt that there was no space that my perspective and what I'd been going through for years by that stage, or that it had been serving any purpose, or that in any way it had been real to me. And actually, that was my whole life for a few years. My whole life was about controlling my appearance, or dictated by how I felt about my body, or shutting down my body to go to school, and extreme anxiety. And I'd organized my whole day around it, and affected so many things. And just to be said, well, that's wrong, isn't it? Shouldn't be coping like that. Should be coping like this. Didn't help me in any way to even if I did change, to grieve for that time that I'd lost, or for that suffering, or that discharge of relief that I felt when I first realized that it was a problem. When I talked to my parents, there was no space to carry on doing that. It was just that approach was really clinical, and clinical, I mean, in the cold way. And there was no room for the suffering to be acknowledged. Somebody else does get that I've been doing these things for a reason. And yes, you want somebody to get better and you want somebody to change. I completely agree with that. But if you completely override or overlook the reasons why they have been engaging in those behaviours in the first place, which is usually some kind of suffering, then I don't think that you ever move beyond it. I think that you get sort of a roadblock, which is unprocessed. And there wasn't space for that. In my family, I think they found it quite difficult to cope with me not feeling great, and they've had their own problems as well. And I didn't trust any of them because they felt so threatening to my whole view of the world or myself. And it brought out all the worst parts in me, reinforced to me that I was a horrible person, I was worthless. I was so motivated to lose weight week to week. I felt that was the only thing I could achieve in my life because I wasn't going to school. If I think about it, I know possibly what the goal was. I never really got it. I was thinking that surely at some point this will get so bad that somebody will step in or realize that there's more to me than just these behaviors.
For sure. And I think you've also highlighted something that's really key when it comes to recovery, that part of the complexity of it is once you've got certain negative coping mechanisms and once you've experienced certain mental illnesses, you are in many ways more prone to fall back into them. I would argue that it's far more likely to be caused by emotional strain, that it's not the tools that you have that maybe you got from something like CBT aren't working, because generally they're taught because they're very consistently effective. But at times your emotional struggle overpowers that. And so then for the emotional struggles that you're experiencing to not be acknowledged through your recovery, well, then of course they're going to overwhelm you again and your recovery is going to be halted, maybe even reversed.
Yeah, I think that I agree that it's not that you don't have the skills anymore that you perhaps might relapse, because when you do learn skills in CBT or DBT, dialectical behavior therapy, these skills are amazing and you learn them and they do work. But I think that often the relapse might happen not because your skills are down, although we do need to kind of practice them to keep them going. It could be a particularly stressful time where you don't feel you have as much resource to use those skills. I think when I look back at my experience of developing or recognizing that I had mental health problems, it was very rooted in the context. It was very rooted in not feeling at ease in school. And throughout my recovery, all the years that I've experienced an eating disorder since, social factors have been really, really important. It's been the times when I've really struggled with relationships that I've leaned more on the eating disorder. And so when I look back to when I developed it, there were loads of needs that weren't being met then. Or I'm happy to put myself in situations where I don't get my needs met because I know that the eating disorder will always be there for me. So, for example, if I'm having a social situation where I'm really not getting on with a group of friends, or a relationship where I feel that my needs are not met at all, I will maybe stick with that because I know that I can discharge my pain about it,
right,
with binging and purging, for example.
Yeah, and there's maybe even a safety in that, that you feel you've somewhat got used to that instability and lack of support, and so it feels familiar.
Yeah, I think that also you might feel that, oh, it's not as bad as it was then, so, you know, therefore it's okay, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it is.
And so we've talked a lot about your experience in the initial support. Would you mind sharing how things went from there?
Yeah, I think that's a long story for many, many podcast episodes or an autobiography. But I think that takes us up to, you know, late teenage years. And I think the really unfortunate thing is that I left school and I left child and adolescent mental health services probably worse than when I went in, and with an untreated eating disorder, because there were no specialist services at the time in Wales, where I come from. And my life since then has been alongside this eating problem that's varied from anorexia to bulimia, back to anorexia, back to bulimia. And that takes its toll on you physically and financially, having to buy a lot of food. So it's had a really big impact. I have managed to access some treatment at certain times. But when it comes to thinking about recovery, I think I find that word quite difficult, really. And people often ask me, where am I in my recovery? Or actually, most people say, how did you recover? That's the first question I would get from a journalist is, oh, what made you get better? Or what was the thing that helped you recover? And I always say, well, what makes you think that I've recovered? Because I look well, or because I...
And do they look very scared when you say that?
And then they look like they put their foot in it, you know, and that I might report on them to mental health charities or something. But, you know, recovery is... interesting and difficult word for some people. I think some people are very at home with it, but for me, I find it challenging for a lot of different reasons. And part of that is because recovery to me suggests that you need to go back and recover something that you lost. Like it's almost like, you know, you back up your phone and there's a recovery spot for it, and you go back to that date and it goes, you know, all the data comes back on your phone. Or you drop something half a mile ago and you have to walk back to that point to pick it up to recover it, or get towed away by, you know, your car breaking down. And for me, I don't want to go back to being a 14 or 15 year old because that wouldn't be appropriate. And also, I can't remember what it was like before. And if I think back to being diagnosed, I think, well, there were many years before that when I had problems that were to do with my mental health that I didn't recognize. Quite difficult. And in some ways, I think it almost writes off some of the experience that has happened in between, because whilst I've had a lot of difficulty with my mental health, it has been a very rich life, and it's been a very rich experience that has actually also brought me lots of really positive and amazing and wonderful experiences that I wouldn't have had if I'd have been well the whole time. I think about all of those wonderful people that I've met. For me, the word that I really like is discovery, because I have to now find a way of living my life that doesn't involve something that has been there for so long. So it's about something that's completely different to what I'm used to. Half of my life has been with an eating disorder, and my life is so different at this age than it was then. So it's about learning to find a new way that doesn't involve perhaps those behaviours or that identity, replacing those with new things. And that is much more exciting to me as an idea, rather than saying, okay, so all that stuff was rubbish, I'm going to go back to the reset point. Because yes, a lot of that stuff was really rubbish, but there was still stuff to notice and appreciate. There are still wonderful things to notice about life, even if you're really, really suffering.
Right. I think that's a really great way of framing it, actually, by breaking down what recovery is and finding alternative ways to look at it. It stops you from writing off those periods of your life when you were still also growing and learning. You were still building more positive skills. And so I like that way of looking at it, because I'm the same. Among other things, I don't think I'd have the tools to have a show like this. I don't think I'd have a lot of the empathy that I have. I don't think I'd feel part of a community in a way that I do. That in many ways, my experience of mental ill health, even though at times it isolated me, now that I've progressed so much, it's actually the thing that makes me feel most human and most at home with other people, because we all have difficulties in common. And I've learned to understand other people's by understanding my own.
Absolutely. And, you know, I do a lot of work in teaching yoga and fitness and that kind of stuff. And people want to be at home in their bodies, and they want to be really familiar with their bodies and notice when they get injuries and be really in tune with what ranges of movement work for them and all of that kind of stuff. And getting that intimate relationship with your physical existence, I think that we all could do with that intimate relationship with our mental and emotional life as well. And having had mental health problems has just made that absolutely necessary for me. But I'm not sure whether I would be so attuned if I hadn't had that experience. And some of the things that I value absolutely the most about life, I value them because I didn't have them. Like, I haven't felt a strong sense of connection to other people for very long periods of time in my life. And I felt profoundly lonely, for example. So for me, connection is so important. And I know that because I know what it's like not to have had the connection. And I think that we live life by contrasts, and some of us maybe have more light and shade than others. And I think I wouldn't personally like to have a life in the grey area, but I also don't want to be pinging from one to the other in a way where I didn't feel at ease. But I think that I have really learned so much from all of that. And when I do accept it, I feel so much more compassionate to myself. I feel so much more I was doing the best that I could, and that there was a lot to learn from it.
Definitely. I think that's so true. And unfortunately, we need to start wrapping up. Looking back on your experiences, and particularly with the mental illnesses you've dealt with, one being OCD, which is an anxiety condition, and then the others being within eating disorders, do you feel that the gendering that can exist around those types of conditions influenced the treatment you got and what you needed in terms of support not being recognised sooner?
I think gender definitely has been a factor. Just like people will look at you and think, yes, you're young or old, people discriminate on the basis of gender, and that does play out in services or perhaps how you're treated. And maybe I wouldn't have been treated as, oh, you're badly behaved if I wasn't a boy, perhaps, by my school. I think they just saw me as a badly behaved boy, perhaps. I don't know. When I was trying to get help for eating disorders, I think that it can be difficult as a male, because perhaps the thresholds for weights at which you might be accepted to services don't reflect when actually men will tend to have larger frames and that kind of stuff. So I think that sometimes it really doesn't get captured. And when I developed anorexia the first time, I was given a book which talked about when you lose your periods, and the book referenced she will this, she will experience that. And I just felt that was really, really alienating. And there wasn't necessarily space for me to talk about what was happening for me. And there are specific changes that happen for men in anorexia, for example, that aren't really reflected in the literature that you might find. So I think that it did make me feel quite alienated, and that was something that I was already struggling with anyway. So that was problematic. And I think, though, there is a caution in services to talk about some of the real nitty-gritty stuff that can be really important to people. And I think that one of those is, as somebody who comes from the LGBT community, I'm not making any judgments there about that community, but I've struggled with my relationship with body image, food, eating, and sex as well. And that has been something that's reinforced my eating disorder at some points in my life. So this is quite a specific example of the problems that I've experienced, but there was no space to talk about that. That was so off the radar. So I think that there are lots of things that can be missed by services, but I think that gender is quite difficult. And also because pressures on body image for men are growing. And I think that we don't really know as men how to deal with that. And women have had to experience that for such a long time. And they have a movement, and we don't really have that movement amongst men supporting men in terms of, well, how can we push back against some of these pressures that are being put on our bodies? And we're not as equipped, and we don't necessarily have the language to talk about that.
And also I think the focus is different, and particularly with eating disorders could be quite harmful, that the focus on men's health is less emotional and more physical. And so if you're already in a difficult and dangerous relationship with your body, and then the main answer that's given is do more sport, that could very easily become a whole new dangerous part of your eating disorder.
Yeah, I think these messages, they maybe for most people they don't impact them, or they don't turn into behavioural changes, but for some people who are particularly at risk, they can be quite damaging. And I don't think we've really thought about that and how that affects men. That's not saying that one group is being put against the other. I think that we have space to support everyone. And what about people who are non-binary, who have very little representation or very little consideration of their needs, perhaps in eating disorder services as well?
And you've reminded me of, in talking about the differences of how this can affect women and men and people of other gender identities, one of the most difficult things to hear on the podcast that I've experienced was speaking to another guy that had experienced eating disorders called Tom Robert. And he said one of the main things he struggled with that wasn't acknowledged through support, feeling that he'd forever stunted his growth. So he'll now live a life never knowing how tall he would have been because of how much this affected his body, his health, and his development from a young age. I don't think it's something that you think of, and it may not be something that could be as concerning if you're female, where there is more of a societal focus on being small and cute, whereas for a guy, it's more being tall and strong. Yeah, that's what you've reminded me of. So we will finish up there then. Thank you so much for joining us. Is there any final message you'd want to share if people are really connecting to your story?
Perhaps one of the most challenging things when you're experiencing not just mental health problems, but any kind of difficulty, is to feel so alone with that. And that when you bring that to somebody, they don't recognize the reality of that for you. And they brush it off, or they don't respond in a way that is compassionate. And by that, I mean really acknowledging that that's difficult for you, even if they can't see the rationality or the justification for it. And what I would try and tell people is your experience, however off the wall it might seem to other people, is real for you in some sense. But we have to have compassion for the fact that we don't always see things perfectly rationally. And who would want to be a perfectly rational being anyway? And that it is valid to feel how you feel. And even if you don't get met with the responses that you want, and you try and get help and it's not available, it doesn't mean that what you're going through isn't real and that it's not worth hearing. It's just that you haven't found the spaces for it to be heard, and you do deserve it to be heard and to be met with that compassionate response.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And I'd say, as a really general tip for that, is that's the power of listening. that even if you're not a medical professional, even if you don't know anything about what someone's going through, if you start from a place of listening, doing your best to understand, and really kind of push down the temptation to jump in and correct things, even if it feels the helpful thing to do, if you can start by listening, then when you do speak up, you'll be coming from a much more understanding place.
Yeah. I think listening is one of the most fundamentally overlooked things and most valuable things. Yeah, I would just really like times a thousand.
Great. All right. So we'll finish up there then. Thank you so much for joining us.
That's okay. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.